This is Conor Lennon from UN News. Tom Fletcher, the UN head of humanitarian affairs, has been forced to make brutal cuts to his organisation as major donors in the rich world slash their aid in international development spending. On Thursday, he joined me from the UN offices in Kabul, Afghanistan, at the end of a three-week visit to some of the most vulnerable communities in the country, witnessing firsthand the consequences of the aid slowdown, which include the closure of around 400 medical centres, negatively impacting the healthcare of some 3 million people. In public, Mr. Fletcher has challenged policymakers who signed off on aid cuts to come to Afghanistan to see for themselves the effect they're having on the population, and said that the effect of aid cuts is that millions die. I started by asking him if he uses this kind of blunt language when he talks to politicians and leaders in private.
This is the first visit because, of course, there was a bit of a time lag after the aid cuts before you really see the impact. You know, lots of programs are still running and running down. But here, 400 clinics closed in the last few weeks. You know, that has a real world impact. And you can sit there and talk to people who aren't going to get the medical support that they need because of those closures. So it's become much more real for me on this trip. I'm spending time. I've just come from sitting with the NGOs. They're laying off half their staff, the local NGOs that we're so keen to protect in the midst of all these, that of course the ones hardest hit. So this is real. And, you know, we try and find different ways to communicate this in slightly gentler terms. But ultimately, of course, people will die as a result of these cuts. If they didn't, then, you know, what have we been doing all this time with this money? That's the great tragedy at the heart of it. Now, so what do the politicians say? I think there are broadly two camps here. You've got politicians who are doing this really reluctantly because they're being forced to make really tough decisions, because their economies are struggling, because of pressures from taxpayers to do things differently. And they feel the weight of the decision, genuinely. They know the importance of what we do. They know the importance of the humanitarian effort, and they're very sad about the choices they're having to make. That's one conversation. And there are another group of politicians who I fear celebrate. They certainly, in their public messages, seem to boast about aid cuts, to take credit for aid cuts. And I think it's that group that I would love to bring to sit with a mother who has lost her child because she was forced to cycle pregnant to hospital 3 hours away.
But you said yourself that, you know, your perspective seems to have changed simply from seeing all these things yourself firsthand. And yeah, before you took this job, you were a diplomat. You worked with many senior politicians. So as you said, you know, they have to often make decisions that are between two bad options when they're deciding what they do want to fund, what they don't want to fund. I'm just wondering, now you have this perspective, do you think you would have advised senior politicians differently? And as you have this perspective now, do you think that this is a widespread problem throughout diplomacy?
I think I would have advised them to preserve, defend the aid budgets. I did at the time. You know, I used to work for three different UK prime ministers in a period when there was that commitment to 0.7%. And, you know, after I left government, I spent a lot of time advocating not cutting the aid budget. I was one of those annoying ex-diplomats who writes letters to the Financial Times and goes out in the media making life difficult for the government when they do have tough choices to make. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are different ways to make this case. There is the strong moral, ethical case for human solidarity and human compassion. And I believe that case stands on its own, unequivocally. Then there is a more transactional case. And we are in a more transactional world now, whether we like it or not, which is that it is in your national interest to spend overseas. If you want to make your country great, then you don't retreat from the world. You go out and meet global challenges where you find them, because otherwise the next pandemic, the next economic crash, the overflow of migration that will be driven by climate crisis and poverty and conflict in the future, they come in your direction, and you can't build a wall big enough to keep those problems out. So I think there is that more pragmatic argument too. And then I think there's also a soft power argument that you make your country magnetic. You show leadership on the world stage by being out there helping countries to deal with these challenges at source. Now, I don't know which of those arguments work with which constituencies. We have to adapt them. We have to be creative in how we make the case. We have to be firm in defending what we do, proud of what we've achieved so far. I think the danger, and you know, I often make this mistake in talking about being more efficient and prioritized and smart, is that we sometimes seem to be embarrassed about what we've done so far. Now, we believe as humanitarians, we can get better and better. We want that more than anyone because we believe in what we do. We believe in the mission. But we can also take great pride in the fact that our community has taken millions, hundreds of millions, out of poverty and saved hundreds of millions of lives.
Running OCHA is never easy. We've spoken to your predecessors, as you can imagine, and it's always been, you know, the toughest, seemingly one of the toughest jobs that there are. But you do seem to have joined at a particularly difficult time for OCHA, for the UN in general, and the UN's ability to help the most vulnerable. You know, you've announced 20% cuts across the board back in February. Can you confirm that you're still going to have to make those cuts? And also, how do you do it in a way that doesn't make your job in terms of helping the most vulnerable, help making that job even harder?
Yeah, that's the big challenge. Look, it is rough. It's a very, very tough time to have started with those cuts hitting. You know, my term in office will coincide almost to the day with the presidential term of the second presidential term of Donald Trump, for better or worse. Let's see. And, you know, I do have fairly regular therapy sessions with my predecessors where I articulate how envious I am of the periods when they were in office. But this job is always challenging, as you say. The SG teases me that I'm the right man at the wrong time, which is great. You know, these are really brutal choices that we're making across the sector. The sector will probably shrink by a third, and there may be more funding cuts ahead. And of course, we'll be out there looking for new partners, trying to convince the skeptics, bringing the private sector in, changing the public conversation around solidarity. But that money isn't going to come back anytime soon. And so we've got to make these tough choices across the sector, including in OCHA. As you say, we're cutting by about 20%.
You know, you say the money's not coming back soon. So is that based on conversations with the US administration? I mean, I assume that you have regular contact with people in the administration. Is there any hope that they could reverse course or that your message is getting through to them?
So as you know, if you're a humanitarian, you never lose hope. We operate in the most hopeless environments and we always try and stay sort of defiantly positive. And so I'll take that spirit into these conversations. One challenge has been, of course, that the American administration is still appointing key people to many of these positions. And many of those who were our interlocutors have gone. Many who arrived have then left fairly quickly. So there is that conversation, that dialogue going on. I've not given up. I'm really positive about the way that, you know, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, has talked about the need to protect life-saving aid. And I really want to get into that conversation with him and see what his vision is for America's role in saving lives around the world. So I've not given up completely, but we also have to be realistic and we have to work with the money that we have, not the money that we need or the money that we wish we had.
And given that situation, are we going to have to completely rethink aid, what it is, what it entails, how it's funded, the pros and cons? Are we going to have to fundamentally change the system of aid giving that's been going on for so many decades, led predominantly by the UN?
We're going to have to change. We have to preserve the best of what we've learned. We have to have confidence in what we delivered so far. But we're going through a process now that we call the humanitarian reset. Three phases. First is regroup, where we're actually recognizing we're becoming smaller. And we're trying to do that in a way that does as little damage as possible. It will do damage, but that ensures we minimize the hit to the essential life-saving work we do. Then alongside that, we're reforming, becoming more efficient, smarter. I launched on my first day in office, November 18th, a big efficiency drive across the sector. The IASC, which is the body that coordinates our sector, has backed that up and actually taken it to the next level in terms of taking the layers out of the system and making sure we end the turf wars and focus on what we each do well, the extra value we bring, make sure we're doing much more at a local level, close to the communities we serve. And then, yes, renewal is now the next phase of that work. Very hard to do that while you're regrouping and reforming, but we've got to do all three things now at the same time. And that means bringing moral imagination, radical thinking to how humanitarian work will operate in the future. It means recognizing that the mission is the right one, that there is a movement out there who will back us, but that we have to rebuild the delivery mechanism in a different way.
And that movement, as you say, I mean, that, does that imply that there are groups or several member states out there? I mean, it goes back to having hope, Tom. You know, you want to be hopeful about this. So there are plenty of nation states, senior people out there who do still want to fly the flag for the sort of work that you're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got a number of donors who are staying solid despite the funding crises that they're all facing. We've got new donors emerging and growing. I've been in the Gulf. I've been in China last week, and that engagement is deepening. We've got more innovative ideas about how to bring in the private sector. And also, I believe really strongly in the role of individuals in all of this, in finding ways to ensure that we're reaching that wider movement beyond governments, beyond member states. You know, I think we could set a target of 1%, you know, not for states to hit, but for nations to hit and challenge populations to fill the gaps that their governments are leaving.
So I want to come back to Afghanistan, because that's where you're speaking to us from right now, and a little bit more about the trip, which we've already covered on UN News. But obviously in Afghanistan, on top of the acute drop in funding, you've got that chronic problem of the attitude of the Taliban's stance towards women, access to education, employment prospects for women and girls. I mean, these have all been drastically reduced since the Taliban took power. I know you spoke to some very senior Taliban officials, including the governor of Kandahar province, in-depth conversations. Are you able to have a constructive discussion about this issue of women and how they're treated under this regime?
Yes, we are. And, you know, there are two really core issues here for us. One is the role of women in humanitarian work, and we simply cannot deliver without them. They're brilliant, brilliant colleagues. We rely on them completely, and we couldn't be here without them. And the second is, of course, the wider issue around rights for women and girls, including education, and the fact that millions of girls have had that right stolen from them over the last 3 years. Difficult conversations, but we've had long, long meetings here. I come at this as a former diplomat, as someone who believes in dialogue, who believes in respect and trust and listening, and in recognizing that we have different cultures, different traditions, different heritages, different beliefs. I don't carry my beliefs any more lightly than the people I'm talking to here carry theirs. I believe just as strongly in the rights of women. And I think a dialogue is the way through that conversation. Yeah, you know, this came up in every one of my meetings across, you know, many, many meetings with ministers and governors. And I think we can make progress on this issue if we do approach it in that spirit of dialogue. And if we always put at the core of our approach the rights of Afghan women and girls, you know, what is really, really in their interests above all. And, you know, I've been saying to people here, my last job was at Oxford University, and our best students were coming from Afghanistan. Our best students were Afghan women, and yet we couldn't celebrate the amazing achievements. And that is heartbreaking, not just for them, but for Afghanistan. Afghanistan needs that human potential that they represent and that these millions of girls not currently in education represent. So this will be an ongoing conversation. I feel confident that we've laid some good foundations during this visit. I know many people are working on the issue, and I will be back again and again to continue that dialogue.
And last question for you before you go. You've been kind of running at pace since you took the job, but you haven't really been in the job that long. And when you joined, did you have a goal? Like, by the end of my mandate, I want to achieve this, this, and this. And if so, what were those priorities?
It's a great question. I mean, I did. I wrote out a list of 10 priorities over, I don't know how long I get. You know, the average ERC lasts about 3 years. They burn through us pretty quickly. It is, as you say, a kind of very hectic travel schedule. And you're dealing with the world's worst crises. And so, you know, there's a bit of wear and tear along the way. So actually, my number one objective was to survive as long as possible, because I think it's traumatic for an organization getting new people in, house training them, getting them up and running. And so actually being around for a period of time and learning from the organization, learning from those we serve, and then putting that into action is a serious objective in itself. I did come into it with an objective around reform of the humanitarian sector. This is before Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and others started talking about efficiency and prioritization and cuts. I do believe that we can do this much more effectively and much closer to those we serve. And so I was already determined to deliver that. And then thirdly, third big one is ultimately about saving lives. And I believe it's our job to save hundreds of millions of lives and to define everything we do against that yardstick. And so I do have in my mind numbers that we should be trying to hit as a UN humanitarian system of the number of lives that we can save every year.